into being. Are we alone in the universe? All my life, I have sought to understand the universe.
Yeah. Bad boy, baby. Loon.
It's your turn now, Marco, here on AstroTalk. You're listening to AstroTalk, CITR's weekly astronomy talk show with your host, Marco.
Good day. It is Thursday, July 24th, and this is Marco on AstroTalk. Last week, I talked a little bit about the sun, or a lot about the sun. This week, I'm going to do something different. I had an interview with Professor Jamie Matthews, the head of the department at the Department or Astronomy, UBC Faculty of Astronomy. So today I talked about, or today we're going to listen to that interview. And there's many interesting things we talked about. The first part of the interview, we will get to know the man, Professor Jamie Matthews. Second part, we're going to talk about the MOST telescope, which Jamie Matthews is in charge of. It's Canada's pride and joy. It's our own telescope out in outer space. And the third part of the interview, some more topics about space. So enjoy this interview with Professor Jamie Matthews. Okay, I'm now in the physics building. I think it's called the James Hebb building.
No, it's physics and astronomy.
Physics and astronomy.
Sorry. Building, you got to leave it in, and it's the Hennings building.
Oh, it's the Hennings building. Yeah, I studied here years ago, and it shows I didn't study very much because I don't know the name of the building. So anyway, we're here with Professor Jamie Matthews, an astronomy professor at the University of British Columbia, and he's graciously consented to an interview. Now we're going to talk about Professor Matthews' fields of study. But first, I'm going to ask him a question. Professor Matthews, how did you get associated with Elvis Presley's brain?
And first, feel free to call me Jamie.
Okay, Jamie, thank you, sir.
I use Professor Matthews when I'm writing letters of reference for people or if I'm trying to get a good seat on
a
plane.
Okay, thank you, Jamie.
Jamie is fine.
Thank you, Jamie.
You've done your research, and I am probably the world's leading astro-Elvisologist. It all came about. It started in 1987 when I was in Chile on a mountain peak at an observatory in Chile.
What's the name of the observatory?
The one I was at the time was Cerro Tololo, the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory, CTIO.
Okay.
And I was observing, I was still a graduate student at the time, and I was observing classes of pulsating stars, vibrating stars, and obtaining spectra of them. Now, while I was on the mountain peak, light arrived on Earth from a supernova explosion. The supernova explosion had happened about 170,000 years before, but it took that long for the light showing us that the star had exploded to reach Earth because the star was in one of the nearest neighboring galaxies to our own called the Large Magellanic Cloud.
Was that supernova 1987A?
That is indeed it, the 1987A, because it was the first one to be detected in the year 1987. Now, it was actually first reported by a Canadian who was on a mountaintop in Chile at the right time, at the right place. The Canadian was Ian Shelton on another mountaintop at Las Campanas. Probably about a couple hundred kilometers away from Cerro Tololo. So I'm the Canadian who did not discover the supernova of the century. Thank you very much. The reason why this was so exciting is because this was the brightest supernova to have been observed in 400 years. And the last time that a supernova was bright enough to be seen by eye, there were no telescopes. There were none of the sophisticated instruments that we had available in 1987, and so this was a unique opportunity, a historic opportunity to be able to study the death of a massive star and to test firsthand a lot of the theories that we had about how stars die. Now, because it was so important, because it was the only star in the sky that you could see by eye that was not in our Milky Way galaxy, because it made the front page, the cover of Time magazine, which was an illustration of an exploding fireball and a one-word headline, boom, exclamation mark, the media descended upon the mountains and the observatories in Chile. I guess you don't really descend upon a mountain, but they came to a place where very few people come. And we found ourselves in the unusual circumstance of having to talk to lots of media at the remote observatories at Cerro Tololo, Las Campanas, and so on. And amongst the media that I dealt with was a team, a reporter and photographers from Discover magazine. And they had asked for permission to spend the night with me at the dome at the telescope when I was collecting data on the supernova. Now, I had switched my observing program once this thing happened, and I was obtaining spectra, medium resolution spectra.
So what is spectra for our listeners that are not familiar with spectra?
So spectrum is a rainbow. I mean, when you see a rainbow, it's basically water droplets and mist during or after a rain shower that are spreading the white light of the sun into its component colors, and that's where you see the colors of the rainbow. Astronomers use instruments, and when we collect the light with telescopes, we can also produce a rainbow. We can spread the light of the stars out into miniature rainbows, but with much finer detail and beyond the ranges of wavelengths that you and I can see by eye. And so, we can, from those spectra, from those finely sampled rainbows, we can determine much of what we know about stars in terms of the composition, in terms of temperature, in terms of how they're moving, and so on. And so this is when I was following from the hours and days after this cataclysmic stellar explosion, the gases as they expanded, as different elements would become apparent. And so the spectroscopy was important, but it's kind of a technical thing. And so I was explaining, apologizing to the reporter that medium resolution spectroscopy of the supernova was probably not the stuff of which headlines would be made, and he might not get a Pulitzer Prize for this article, at least based on the stuff that I was doing. And I jokingly said to him, if I wanted to have the headlines, what I would do is make an anonymous phone call to the National Enquirer or Weekly World News, which is no longer published, but some of these wacky tabloids, with headline stories like astronomers, fake exploding star in desperate attempt to attract girlfriends, or Shirley MacLaine mourns the death of close personal friends in stellar explosion. The reference there, some of your listeners may be familiar with Shirley MacLaine, the film actress and so on, but around that time in the 80s, she was sort of showing her slightly, surreal, new agey side, and was claiming to have been in communication with blue aliens from the star cluster, the Pleiades, and so that was a direct reference to that. And then one of the jokes I made was actually meant to contain a little bit of educational value, because every atom in your body and my body and in the Earth and in everybody's bodies at one time would have been in the core of a star which exploded as a supernova. That's where the raw materials that make us and the air we breathe and the constituents of the planet in which we live on all were generated in a supernova explosion and then distributed into the interstellar medium to seed the clouds of gas for the next generation of stars. And so we were the beneficiaries of that. And so I turned that on its head in my joke, and I said I would phone with the headline, "Exploding Star Contains Atoms from Elvis Presley's Brain."
scientists confirm that the king of rock and roll lived 170,000 years ago in another galaxy. Now, the twist being that, you know, Elvis Presley's brain actually contained atoms from a supernova explosion. So I just turned it backwards and said, you know, the supernova contained atoms from Elvis Presley's brain.
But that's something you became known for.
Well, it's because this reporter, you know, unbeknownst to me, was either taking very careful notes or recording, like you are. And so when the Discover article appeared, not only was I quoted saying that, but it was the headline of the article.
I see. Okay.
And that issue of Discover came out the week of the very first joint meeting of the Canadian and American Astronomical Societies right here in Vancouver, at a time when I was looking for a job, having just gotten my PhD, and I was looking for what we call a postdoctoral fellowship, the kind of astronomical scientific equivalent of a medical internship. And so this was a big hot seller during this joint meeting, and I remember I was just thinking, oh well, you know, this is not good. And a friend, a fellow astronomy student, Doug Welch, who's out of McMaster University, I remember he put his arm around me and said, "Don't worry, Jamie, this is something that you'll be able to laugh about during your long years of unemployment."
Okay, before I go on to ask a bit more about some of the things you just talked about, I have to stop, and if the listeners were here in this room, we could see Jamie has some amazing rings. Can you tell me about one of those rings?
Okay.
He has four rings that are just the most amazing rings I've ever seen.
Okay, so this is perfect for radio.
Yes.
I never wore rings up until about 3 years ago. I never wore any jewelry. And then I was in a shop here in Vancouver, Millennium, downtown, in which a friend was managing it. And he had brought in a ring from a British designer, a woman from England, whose line is called Alchemy. And I'd never seen any ring quite like it. It was a cannon with a sighting scope which unfolded in chains. And
that's the one you have on?
No, I don't actually. I'm not wearing that one. And but it fit one of my fingers. I wore it out of the store. I paid for it, and I wore it out of the store. And now my fingers look like the hardware aisle at Canadian Tire. So I have a couple of the Alchemy rings on, and the one I think you were looking at that you think might be the cannon is actually a telegraph key.
Okay.
And here, there's actually some sound. Here I can, this is my version of a cell phone. I don't have a cell phone, but if I hook up a wire to this, I could actually send Morse code people. The other alchemy ring is the eye. Well, it's a blue eye, and one could think of it as the blue eye that wards away evil, which is very common in, like, for example, Turkish and some Mediterranean cultures. There, speaking of the eye, though, to go with the eye, there is a ring which unfolds. Everybody notices the compass of the ring. No one ever notices that it unfolds into a refracting telescope, a working telescope. And your listeners can't see me looking through it, but that's what I'm doing. And then there's a thing that's, kind of a cyberpunk thing that looks like it's pumping some kind of red fluid into my bloodstream. And that could be red wine or red absinthe or Kool-Aid or whatever. I kind of like the look of it. And so,
yes, viewers, if you were here, you could see these an amazing wristwatch.
Well, this isn't actually a watch. This is a thermometer. It's a working thermometer, and it is warm in this room right now. It's saying 24.5 degrees Celsius.
It looks like a mega huge watch.
Yeah, it is. It is very big. And my watch, in fact, is this over here. And again, not very good for radio. It's very colorful, but the colors change as the time goes on, and so when we get to the end of the interview, you'll have to remind yourself to check and see how different the pattern looks.
Yes, viewers, Jamie has an amazing assortment of jewelry on his body. But now if we can get back to a little bit about astronomy.
Okay.
I was sidetracking there. What kind of, first, I think supernova 1987A, that could only be seen in the southern hemisphere,
correct? That's correct.
Okay. Now, what kind of spectra would we expect from a supernova?
Well, a supernova is, you know, the death of a star, but only stars that are
much more massive than our sun will die in that.
Maybe 20 times more massive?
No, up to like six to eight times is sort of the threshold above that. The sun will die not with a bang but a whimper, or like swelling up into a red giant and leaving behind a corpse that we would call a white dwarf, something with about half the mass of the sun.
So what kind of spectra is from a supernova?
The size of the Earth. So what happens is if it's exploding, there's the gas is flying out in all directions out into interstellar space, and therefore it's flying at high speed. And one of the things that the laws of physics is that if a source of light waves is moving towards you or away from you, then the wavelength of that light is shifted by something called the Doppler effect. And so as you're observing the light from the supernova and spreading it out into its component wavelengths, you see the Doppler shifted features, you see, that represent velocities that are like, 10% of the speed of light, measured in tens of thousands of kilometers per second. And so you see those features, and that evolves in terms of from hour to hour, day after day, as the expansion continues and things slow down, and it starts to reveal, the kind of the core of where all the violent stuff was happening. That kind of light starts to escape, and you start to see other evidence of some of the other elements that are present in that. So, really,
which elements are present? Which elements are present in a supernova explosion?
Well, I mean, the elements that are primarily present in a supernova explosion in terms of quantity are the same as the elements that are primarily present in the sun or in the star before it exploded, hydrogen and helium. Stars are essentially about 98% hydrogen and helium by mass. And then everything else in the periodic table is only 2%. And so the other elements are there, the things that, as I said, that make us.
So let's move on now to what you are perhaps most famously known as, which is the MOST telescope, which you have called the Hubble telescope. Can you?
We will pause now for a station ID.
Fred Durst?
He's like Iggy.
Oh, you are sorely mistaken.
Play something from $3 Bill, y'all.
What is that?
That's the landmark Limp Bizkit album.
Limp Bizkit? Oh, my God. I mean, they...
Wait, you don't agree that those are the most crucial grooves you've heard since Funkadelic?
What, Limp Bizkit grooves? Yeah, absolutely.
It's like the ultimate cross between Funkadelic and Rob Tyner.
Yeah, no, I don't agree at all.
Oh, you do not deserve a radio show.
CITR 101.9 FM, your crucial groove station.
It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS. It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS.
Welcome back. We are going to continue the interview with Professor Jamie Matthews, but just a few comments. As we know, Professor Matthews has a nice assortment of rings, so if we're hit by a solar flare and our communications are knocked out on Earth, Professor Matthews has a little Morse code ring. He can still communicate in some way with people that can pick up his Morse code. And he also has a telescope, so if the power on his ring, one of his telescopes functions as a ring. Later on, we will hear Professor Matthews' Doppler shift in his voice because he is coming close to the mic and then recedes away. So let's see if we can pick up that Doppler shift. But now we're going to continue with the interview and learn more about the MOST telescope, which Professor Matthews is in charge, and a telescope that has made its mark in Canadian space history.
Please tell us more about this piece of machinery.
Okay, so MOST is Canada's first space telescope, and MOST stands for Microvariability and Oscillations of Stars. Microvariabilité, Oscillation Stellaire, and so I made it perfect Canadian acronym. But as you said, we nicknamed it because of its low cost and very small size, given the type of science that it's capable of doing, we nicknamed it the Humble Space Telescope, because it's very small and very inexpensive by comparison to the Hubble Space Telescope. And the MOST was designed to do seismology of stars, to basically detect the vibrations at the surfaces of stars, and then we could use the vibrations to probe their internal structure and their life histories, in the same way as geophysicists can use earthquake vibrations, which travel through the Earth, to figure out what the inside of the Earth is like. The center of the Earth is 6,400 kilometers beneath our feet. Might as well be 6,400 million billion light years for all of our ability to go there. But we know what the interior of the Earth is like thanks to the techniques of seismology and earthquake vibrations. And stars vibrate as well. And if you have enough sensitivity and you have enough time coverage, you can identify the frequencies of the vibrations and use that to basically peel away the outer layers of a star, which to you just looks like a pinpoint of light, and turn it into this sort of three-dimensional thing. But the vibrations are very subtle, and if you're on the ground, on the Earth, looking through the turbulence of the Earth's atmosphere, the thing that makes stars appear to twinkle, and there's this annoying thing that stops you from observing the stars on a regular basis called the sun. And although I'll admit that the sun has its redeeming characteristics, if you want to observe stars continuously from the surface of the Earth, it is a nuisance. And so that's why we went into space to do this. And MOST, Canada's space telescope, was the pioneer, was the first to have the kind of sensitivity to do this. Now, at the same time, although this is why MOST was designed and built and funded by the Canadian Space Agency, the Canadian government, once we were building it, I realized that even I had underestimated what we could do with that sensitivity, with this instrument in the right orbit. And we added to the science exoplanets, studying the nature of planets orbiting around other stars, and we've been able to do exceptionally exciting pioneering work in exoplanetary science as well. And in fact, the scope of the MOST mission and its capabilities have just continued to expand since its launch more than 11 years ago.
So may I ask you now, I've read something that stars, the waves in them ring like gaseous bells, but this ringing or these waves are very faint. So I have read that the MOST telescope is 10 times more sensitive than Hubble. So is it difficult to process sense these waves and then to process them because they're so faint, aren't they?
So yeah, in terms of the sensitivity, one has to be careful in the sense of like saying 10 times more sensitive than Hubble. You know, MOST was designed to do a particular type of measurement better than any other instrument at the time, whereas the Hubble Space Telescope has instruments that can do all sorts of things which MOST is not capable of doing. But that's the whole point, is for us to fill a niche. And yes, the changes in the brightnesses of stars due to these oscillations, especially stars like the Sun. If you were looking at the Sun as if it were a pinpoint of light from a distance of, say, 10 light years away, when there are stars like the Sun that are at those distances and they look like pinpoints of light, the vibrations of the Sun would amount to changes in its brightness of a few parts per million, a few 10,000ths of a percent. Even astrophysicists have a hard time wrapping our heads sometimes around a change in brightness so small. And so I had to come up with a way to describe that in the way a non-rocket scientist might be able to relate. And what I came up with is, imagine, you know, close your eyes and imagine that you've gone to New York City and you're looking at the Empire State Building at night. All the office lights are on, all the office window shades are completely open. You could make the Empire State Building fainter, less bright, by one part in a million, one 10,000th of a percent, by having one person stand beside one window and pull down one window shade by 3 centimeters. And if you had that person move that window shade up and down by 3 centimeters, you would make the Empire State Building oscillate like a star at an amplitude of 1 part per million. And that's what MOST has the sensitivity to detect in certain stars. And we were the first. We were the pioneer in that capability. We were followed into space later by a French satellite mission called Corot, and eventually the Americans got in the act. The NASA mission Kepler, which was originally designed only to search for planets around other stars, and then they realized, and we helped convince them that that we could also be doing this stellar seismology, and that has turned out to be an incredibly productive part of the Kepler mission.
Then MOST is now used to detect extrasolar planets, is that true?
It is, although we're more of an exoplanet explorer than hunter, because MOST has observed thousands of stars, but statistically the odds are if you're going to find planets, you need to be looking at tens of thousands to 100,000 stars, the Kepler mission 160,000, in order to statistically have a sample of thousands of planets. So MOST was never designed to search for planets, but where we know that there are planets, we can study that system and learn things about those planets that nobody else knew about. And if we already know that there are planets there, we have been able to find planets that nobody realized were there in that system. Or sometimes we've been able to correct the impression that the characteristics of the planets that people thought were there were very different. And so, although we have discovered planets, in a manner of speaking, I wouldn't want to emphasize that, because compared to, say, the Kepler mission, which in a survey of 160,000 stars has discovered thousands of planets, when you have a sample of 5,000 stars, the odds are you're going to detect a handful of planets overall. So it really wasn't part of our mission, but that's why I like to describe us as an exoplanet explorer, a virtual explorer, okay, obviously, because we can't visit these worlds.
So let's say now if we had a planet, can you explain to our viewers, you have a small planet which could be part of a exosolar system with many planets.
Mm-hmm.
How can you detect when that planet occults that star or goes in front and dims it by that 1/1,000,000th?
Mm-hmm.
How can you separate the contributions from that planet and the different planets? That sounds like a very difficult task.
Well, it's not. And so what you're describing is what astronomers would call transits. And when a planet passes in front of its parent star, it blocks out a little bit of the light from the star. It's kind of like an eclipse, except that in an eclipse of the sun by the moon, the moon blocks out all of the bright light from the sun. In a transit, it's a planet which is not big enough to block out all the light from the star behind it, but it just takes out a chunk. And there's a small dip in the light from the star. But every time the planet goes around and comes back in front, there's another dip. And so the dips happen like clockwork, dip, 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 whatever then the period of time is the orbital period of the planet. Now that's where, going back to where I said that a mission, if you wanted to search for planets, you have to have a large sample, because the orbits of planets from one system to another, from one star to another, are not lined up. There's no orientation. And so they're all oriented randomly with relative to one another. And you have to look at a very large sample in order to statistically just catch the ones that happen to have orbits that are lined up, so that you see one of these transits, so that you see the dip in the light. Now, if you have more than one planet, I talked about these dips happening like clockwork at a regular rate. Well, each planet is like a different hand in the clock that's moving at a different rate. And so you've got planet B, say, and it's going dip, 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 dip. But then planet C, which is in a larger orbit, is going dip, dip, dip.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Dip. And so on. And each of them has their own period associated with their period. And so we can we can analyze those data and extract all those, recognize the periodicities. At first glance, if you looked at the data, it might, you know, it might be very confusing. You're just sort of saying dip, 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 dip. Dip, 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 dip. But it turns out it's like listening to music and distinguishing all of the different pitches and all the different notes, or even more accurately, digitizing a song and turning it, you know, the kind of thing to turn it into a sound file, and you see all of the kind of the peaks associated with all the frequencies. Here we can do that kind of analysis of the digitized data and extract all of the periodicities, all of the regular clockwork rates of the different hands of the orbital hands of the clock. And so, in fact, as long as the signals are strong enough, as long as we are collecting enough photons that we can convincingly see these dips, these transits, that's actually relatively simple for us to extract the various planets. And right now, I think the record holder beyond our own solar system is, I think, 7. We have exoplanetary systems in which there are 7 stars orbiting around, or 7 planets orbiting around one star. In our solar system, of course, we have 8 planets orbiting around one star, since we nasty astronomers demoted Pluto to the status of a dwarf planet. So I think we're still the record holder, or at least tied for the record. But as our sensitivity improves, as we continue to search, I'm sure that in the coming years, there will be the discovery of a multiple planet system which has more than 8 planets, and we won't even have that galactic championship title.
I saw a quote from your website that says, Canada's strength lies in its ability to design innovative, low-cost microsatellites. But before we get into that, can you please let our listeners know about the pioneering efforts, I think in the 80s and the 90s, on star research at UVic and UBC?
Well, sure. And we were talking about exoplanets and so on, and this is not so much related to space astronomy or space research, but to the fact that the first planets to be found, and until recently, the majority of the planets outside the solar system to be found, were found using a technique that was pioneered right here in British Columbia. My friend and colleague, now retired, Gordon Walker, who was a professor at UBC, and Bruce Campbell, who at the time was a young astronomer at the University of Victoria, developed a technique, an instrument, which was sensitive enough to begin the first real search for planets. In this case, not using this transit technique, looking for dips in light, but to basically look for the influence, the gravitational influence of the planet on the star. The planet you can't see, but the star you can. And when a planet is orbiting around a star, when a planet like the Earth is orbiting around the Sun, it's not just the Sun or the star nailed down in one point and the planet going around it. The reason the planet is orbiting is due to the force of gravity. And the force of gravity is a two-way street. It's a mutual attraction. So the small planet is being forced by the star's gravity to loop around in this large orbit. But the planet is also exerting a gravitational pull, an exactly equal gravitational pull on the star. The difference is that the star is so much more massive than the planet that the planet's gravity doesn't do much to the star, but it does do something. And so as the planet moves in its wide orbit, the star also has to move a little bit. I think of it as like dance. These are dance partners. It's just that one dance partner is much, much heavier than the other, and they're swing dancing with their elbows locked or their hands held, and the arms are acting like gravity to keep them from flying off. And if you have two equal mass partners, two equal weight partners swinging around as fast as they can in a dervish, they're going to swing around a point almost exactly between them. But if you have one very heavy partner and a small partner, say it's a wedding and you've got the big chunky uncle with the tiny flower girl. The tiny flower girl is going to be swinging around in this big loop, and the uncle is just kind of wobbling around a little bit. And that's the situation of a star and a planet, where the uncle would be the star and the little flower girl would be the planet. And so if you can detect that, the motions of the star, the wobble of the star due to the unseen planet, then you can tell the planet's there. You can tell the orbit of the planet, you can tell the size of the orbit, you can tell the shape of that orbit, and you can even get a limit on the mass of the planet. So you can learn a lot about this invisible dance partner if you can see the star's dance moves. But the star's dance moves are very subtle, and the way that you can measure them in principle is through this Doppler effect that I mentioned before from the spectra of light, that when the star is slightly moving towards you, then the wavelengths are shifted to shorter values, and when it's moving away to longer values. And Gordon Walker and Bruce Campbell together developed a technique kind of like a radar gun for stars, except that you don't have to bounce a radio wave off of stars. The stars are providing their own light signal to be able to measure those subtle Doppler shifts for the first time, to be able to detect an unseen planet orbiting around it. And the beauty of this technique is that you don't have to have that perfect billiards table alignment to see the planet passing in front of the star. As long as you're not looking right down on the orbit of the planet, where there is no motion towards you or away from you, then you can measure this this Doppler shift, this Doppler wobble. And so the early planets that were found, and hundreds of the planets that we know of today, were found using that technique, and it all started right here.
That's quite amazing. But let's say if we have a star with many planets, so all the planets are going to be exerting a little wobble.
Yeah.
How do you distinguish each individual?
It's, again, if you look at the motions of the sun with the eight planets and so on, that the dance moves are just a little more complicated because there are eight dance partners. And it's just like I was saying before for this transit technique, where you're looking at the dips, and each planet is like a hand of a clock in which there's dip, 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 and then another set of dip, dip, dip at different rates. Now we don't have just sort of these little dips, like little pulse that you're hearing a time signal on a radio. You're having kind of a wave signature, a change in the what we call the radio velocity, the line of sight velocity of the star. For simplicity, you could think of, let's say, if all the planets were in circular orbits in our own solar system, the planets are generally in orbits close to circles. That's not true for a lot of the other planetary systems we've found. But for simplicity, if you think of them as kind of concentric circles around the star, then the reflex motion, the dance moves of the star due to each planet is going to be like a sine wave in its position and in its speed. If you're plotting up the speed as a function of time, it's, for one planet it would look like a sine wave. And then you add another planet, and it's another sine wave added to that, but just with a different period and a different amplitude, and another planet with a different sine wave. But we have the techniques. I mean, that's the same thing as for us to be able to extract the frequency information in data. You know, we have these kind of frequency analysis techniques. One of the oldest, most established, is known as Fourier analysis, a Fourier transform. And so as long as the signals are strong, as long as the amplitudes of those kind of wave signatures in the data are large enough compared to the noise, then again, it's actually surprisingly simple to be able to distinguish the fact that there are, you know, four different planets in orbit.
We're listening to an interview with Professor Jamie Matthews, a professor of astronomy at the University of British Columbia. I think the Doppler shift in his voice comes pretty soon, so listen for it. Right now, we are going to pause for a show promo, and after that, we'll be back to listen to the final part of the interview with Professor Jamie Matthews.
Hi there, my name is Brandon.
And my name is Mormay.
Do you need help finding yourself?
Do you have questions you're too afraid to ask?
Worry no more, we got your back.
Because we are two university students who have all the answers.
Just kidding.
We'd like to think that.
But what you can do is tune into All Ears at 101.9 FM every second Wednesday at 6 p.m.
to get the best advice that we can offer.
So shoot us an anonymous question
at ask.fm/allearsubc and we'll answer it live on air.
And Honeychild will be all ears.
Can I just ask a question just to get this a little bit more clear for us that are not experts like you? When you say dip, that's a dip in the intensity of the light that the star emits because the planet is moving in front of it.
Yeah, and blocking some of that light that would normally be coming our way. That's absolutely
so. Then a little dip is just a little dip intensity that occurs at a regular period.
Yeah, and if it's a planet, say, the size of Jupiter in our own solar system or around a star like the Sun, that dip in light is about a depth of 1% because Jupiter is a big planet. But if it's a planet the size of the Earth passing in front of a star like the Sun, that dip is more like 1/10,000th, so like 1/1,000th of a percent.
And you said Canada's strength lies in its ability to design innovative, low-cost microsatellites. Can you please let our listeners know a little bit about that?
Well, certainly. One of our strengths, of course, Canada has many strengths. We're good at hockey and, and in astrophysics and in a lot of other sciences. But I think in the context of what I might have been talking about then is that when it comes to space, and we have a lot of strengths in space, but you know, relatively speaking, where the amount of money and resources that we have to apply to space research and space exploration is small, say, compared to the United States or to Russia or to the consortium of European countries that makes up the European Space Agency. And so in order for us to make a real splash in space, we have to identify certain niches, certain things that we can do better than anybody else, certain things that nobody else had recognized was worth doing. One of those things is in robotics, obviously, the Canada arm, the space remote manipulator systems, and so on. Dexter on the International Space Station, that's something where Canada really distinguished itself and carved it out its niche as a pioneer in that kind of space technology. And another is in microsatellites and what we call nanosatellites.
Is that like most?
Most is a microsatellite. If it's less than about 100 kilos, it's designated a microsatellite. If it's less than about 10 kilos, it's designated a nanosatellite. If it's less than about 1 kilo, it's designated a picosatellite. And at the time that we developed most, nobody really believed that you could do astronomy, that there was really any point in putting a telescope or a camera or that kind of instrument on a microsatellite. But the Canadian Space Agency, looking for things in which Canada could really establish itself and be a pioneer, thought, there is a potential for doing science with this size of satellite, a microsatellite. And so they put out a call for proposals for science to be performed with microsatellites, and nobody had really done that before. One of the advantages of a microsatellite in terms of cost is it's not very big, it's not very heavy, and so it's relatively cheap to put into orbit. A normal satellite with conventional technology has to do the kind of science that most does would have a mass of hundreds of kilos, something more on the level of a metric ton or more. And the going rate for putting something into orbit, just the lift charge from going from sea level to a few hundred kilometers above the Earth's surface, is about $20,000 US per kilo. And so if you're sending up something that weighs a metric ton, you've got to pay right up front at least $20 million plus all the other expenses associated with it. That's twice the entire cost of the MOST mission, because our satellite was weighing 54 kilos. I weigh more than the satellite. And we negotiated a really good deal with the Russians for our launch of only $10,000 per kilo. And so the lift cost was $540,000 US, a little more than $500,000 US.
And so that's a substantial savings. That allows you to do things, if you figured out how to pack that capability into that small suitcase, then it gives you the freedom to do stuff at a budget with the kind of resources that we have in Canada, or even individual universities or companies could do. And so it kind of opened up a new frontier. And since then, we've even gone to the smaller scale, based on the success of most in terms of the science and technology, that most DNA has been fed into a NanoSat project called Bright Constellation, a Canadian, Austrian, Polish collaboration, in which now, rather than a suitcase in space, we have car batteries in space in terms of their size and their mass. The telescope studying the several hundred brightest stars in the night sky. And so Canada has really carved out some territory here in which we, in terms of the technology and the science, have shown that you can really do frontline things, cutting-edge science, but you don't need the satellite that's the size of a minivan or a bus, that you can do it. In some cases, if you're clever, if you've identified the problems and you're applying the right kind of technology, with something the size of a suitcase or something the size of a car battery.
So I see that MOST has been fabulously successful because many others are using the satellite now, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, MOST is a Canadian facility, but astronomers from around the world submit to us proposals for science, and we're not obliged to actually give time to anybody, but the important thing about a mission like this is the quality of the science, of the discoveries that we make. And so if somebody comes up to us with a great idea and a great set of targets which we'd never thought about, we will collect those data, and those scientists will be automatically the principal investigators and the first authors of the first publications to come out from those data.
Okay, thank you, Jamie, for your time. Can I fire a few rapid answer questions at you?
Absolutely.
When are we going to go to Mars?
Well, if I had to bet on it, I don't think anybody will be touching down on Mars until later than 2025, maybe 2030 at the earliest.
Are we going to colonize the moon?
Not soon. The reasons, there are scientific reasons to go back to the moon, but that's not necessarily going to justify the high cost. If there are economic reasons to go back to the moon, then I think you might see a foot for colonization, but it would be a very small colony because you have to basically have your own life support facilities, and so the people who would want to colonize the moon would be the kind of adventurous types, the people who would like to have a timeshare in Antarctica or at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. And so I don't think you're foreseeable future, you would see a colony of thousands or tens of thousands of people on the moon, but you might see a colony of dozens or hundreds.
Okay, thank you. Now, another question is NASA going to corral a satellite and dock it at the moon?
You mean an asteroid?
Oh, sorry, asteroid. asteroid. Gee, you got me on that one.
Yeah, so, they've been looking at the proposal. One of the things, Barack Obama may not be a huge fan of human exploration of space, and he's in no hurry for the United States to go back to the moon or even to Mars, really. But he has set as a goal that by the year 2025, that an American astronaut, would set boots on the surface of an asteroid. Now, many of the asteroids are in the asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. That's too far away for us to really hope to send human astronauts in the foreseeable future. But you could send out some kind of robotic probe, a machine that would somehow gently tug or nudge an asteroid back in and put it into orbit around the moon. And then at your leisure, you can kind of go to the moon and land on it and study it and maybe mine it. There is a potential
for mining precious metals on asteroids. So they've been investigating that, looking at various techniques, and that's not science fiction. I mean, I think it is the kind of thing that in principle could happen on a time scale of 10 or 15 years from
okay.
now.
Thank you.
And that concludes our interview with Professor Jamie Matthews, a most interesting person and a noted scholar in astronomy in Canada, one of Canada's leading astronomers. So we have to thank Professor Matthews. And also, did anybody pick out the Doppler ship in Professor Matthews' voice? I think it occurred about the 39th minute, but he moved towards the microphone and he moved back. So there was the Doppler shift. If you picked it out, let us know. You've been listening to AstroTalk on CITR. Listen tomorrow, where I will give the space news at 5 o'clock. The science and technology news at Fridays between 5 and 5:30. This is Marco. You have been listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 FM on the UBC campus.
Here comes success
over my hill
here comes success
here comes my car
Exoplanet yet?
Well, as I said, we've in some sense what we've done is we've uncovered or revealed exoplanet imposters. One exoplanet called 55 Cancri E. The data based on the ground, based on this Doppler wobble technique with all the gaps due to the fact that this annoying thing called the sun comes up and stops you from observing, had fooled the astronomers into thinking they had found a Jupiter-sized planet in a much larger orbit around the star. And with MOST, we were able to put the star under the equivalent of the astronomical equivalent of a police stakeout 24 hours a day for weeks at a time. And we cornered the culprit. The true orbital characteristics and physical characteristics of the planet. And it turns out that this planet goes around its star once every 17 hours and 41 minutes. That's its year, 17 hours and 41 minutes. So if you lived on that planet, you wouldn't keep track of milestones like birthdays or anniversaries or holidays with a calendar. You'd use a clock. You know, hey, honey, it's 3:23, happy anniversary. And this planet, it's a super-Earth, only slightly bigger than the Earth, and solid core, and in fact, based on the most data for this, theoreticians believe that this planet may be very carbon-rich, and the pressure on the carbon in the core of the planet would be enough to turn it into crystalline carbon, and crystalline carbon is diamond, and so we may have really uncovered what some scientists have referred to as a diamond planet, which would be very cool.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate Jamie.
And my pleasure.
You have to see his rings. They're amazing. Okay, we have been talking with Professor Jamie Matthews in a most interesting interview. Thank you very much.
Hi there. My name is Brandon.
And my name is Mormon.
Do you need help finding yourself?
Do you have questions you're too afraid to ask?
Worry no more. We got your back.
Because we are two university students who have all the answers.
Just kidding.
We'd like to think that.
But what you can do is tune into All Ears at 101.9 FM every second Wednesday at 6 p.m.
to get the best advice that we can offer.
So shoot us an anonymous question
at ask.fm/allearsubc and we'll answer it live on air.
And Honeychild will be all ears.
Universe, I know.